My guest today is Hyung Nam, who's an organizer with Portland Metro People's Coalition. And Hyung has been involved in a full range of organizing efforts in the city, and in his not-so-spare time, works as a teacher at Ida B. Wells High School, which until recently was named after Woodrow Wilson, the 28th president of the United States, a white supremacist who enthusiastically screened Birth of a Nation at the White House. And Hyung played no small role in the movement to rename the school. So much respect for that important organizing work, Hyung.
Thank you.
Portland Metro People's Coalition, or PMPC, is a coalition of 24 community organizations, including, among others, AFSCME Local 88, the Alliance for Democracy, Portland chapter of the DSA, Sunrise Movement, PDX, Right to Survive, and many others. PMPC has developed a shared policy platform and also a Bill of Rights rooted in building intersectional community power to advance a vision of the city where, quote, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color and other marginalized people don't have to fear violence from police or white supremacists, where people's homes are safe and healthy to live in, and where everyone can be secure in their housing, food, and water, and mental well-being. A city that takes public health, environmental, and changing climate consequences seriously and acts at the scale that those challenges demand. So PMPC has been actively involved in the city's charter review process, and one aspect of that work focuses around expanding and protecting the Portland City Commons with three areas of focus in particular, including municipal broadband, public banks, land trusts slash surplus property acquisition. So Hyung, can you tell us more about this quite visionary agenda? And it seems like in the age of pandemics, when low-income and disproportionately BIPOC students are marginalized by limited internet access, and many people are working from home, municipal broadband has never been as important as it is today.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we've been working on for a while now. And from my perspective in PMPC, it's really part of what people like Gar Perovitz talks about, community wealth building. I think he talks about it in this kind of a way to make it kind of less sectarian. I mean, of course, we could call it socialism as well in many ways. But I think, you know, to overcome maybe people's ideological discomfort with that, I think if you talk about it in that kind of a way, it really is very practical. I mean, to the point where, you know, the only public bank that exists in the United States right now is in North Dakota. And granted that it was started by populists and socialists, North Dakotans that are far from socialist today very much embrace the public bank and know how well it works, and know the value of having a public enterprise that provides a valuable service to people and actually generates revenue that would be lost to out-of-state corporations and investors. And it's not only a matter of community wealth building and avoiding that kind of extraction of our local wealth and resources, but it's also about how enterprises are run. Are they run for the benefit of the people and the workers, or they run to cut costs to pad profits for investors and salaries for executives? And I think it's part of a different vision of our world that sees a reduced, if not no role for capitalism, and where we can see that economically in the United States, especially, you know, throughout the Cold War, there was such a heavy ideology contrasting in a really distorted way so-called democracy versus communism. And this notion that somehow political democracy, given the huge inequalities of capitalism and the tendencies towards oligarchy and plutocracy, that somehow we could have democracy under capitalism. And I mean, and this is why we thought it was important to intervene in the Charter Commission, because such the big focus has been, you know, changing the form of government and elections and thinking that, well, that's going to give us, you know, better democracy. Well, I mean, most other cities have a city manager, strong mayor, they have district elections, all kinds of things, or even, you know, ranked choice elections. And democracy is still very much challenged in all those places because we have such extreme economic inequality that undermines any kind of democratic society where people might vote once every 2 or 4 years, but they spend more than 40 hours a week working under a dictatorship, under capitalism. And we as ratepayers or consumers have very little choice with these oligopolies that dominate and that provide services that we cannot live without.
So really thinking about these as public utilities.
All over the world, there are places that have had utilities privatized and now are in the process of re-municipalizing or renationalizing it. Like France had a lot of their water privatized. Right now, there are private equity companies that are targeting municipal water systems. This all fits into the neoliberal world, right, where they cut taxes, both federal and local taxes, you know, with Prop 13 movement being the huge example, you know, that set off this anti-tax movement. And so you starve the public and public services to the point where they can't really maintain their infrastructure and services. And then we're not seeing the kind of investments that we need to see from both federal and local governments in infrastructure, partly because, especially on a local level, less so on a federal level, there is a lack of will to raise taxes and raise revenue. So you have public facilities just crumble, and then private investors come in, promise that they can make the investments to keep these things running. And that's the constant threat that we face.
Yeah, and it seems like nationally, municipal broadband has really been making some serious headway. And in Portland, I know that municipal broadband, PDX, right, which arose in 2017 in the wake of the striking down of net neutrality, commissioned or helped organize the county to commission a feasibility study, which came out in September 2020. Can you talk a little bit, you know, about some of the headway that's been made on broadband?
Is the sound?
Okay, there was just a little crackle.
It's, okay.
Oh, it could be my internet connection. Young. Okay. Right. I mean, and I think that's a really critical piece of the municipal broadband picture, right, is bringing in fiber optic cables that they're like 40 times faster than kinds of connections that we have today. I mean, it's ironic, right, that even in the course of doing this interview over Zoom, we're experiencing the kind of unpredictability of the connection, which as both of us are teachers, that is a major, you know, if you're trying to teach online and you've got an unstable internet connection, it's a major issue.
Yeah, we had to change our services twice because it was just always so slow. I mean, we had originally decent, you know, fast broadband for download, but the upload was too slow and that messed us up. So yeah, we have fiber. And again, it's CenturyLink. It's the only service that provides fiber in our area. We have very little choice. And we pay much more than we would under municipal broadband system, as we hope to have here in Portland, and as they do have in many other places where they have, you know, top quality service and pay lower fees. And then on top of it, those fees go towards public revenue to the point where they're able to subsidize low income or, you know, schools or whomever, so that they could either provide the service for free or drastic reduction in price, and everyone else pays less than we would to the major oligopolies. And that is still enough to subsidize free or majorly discounted services for everyone, and to make sure that nobody's left behind.
So already Sandy, yeah. Independence, Oregon. I mean, 2018, Kate Brown created an Oregon broadband office specifically focused on implementing broadband across the state, especially in underserved rural and urban areas. So this is not some impossible vision, right? It's happening all over the country and it can happen.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, you know, with public utilities in general, I think we have to remember that in many parts of the country, including, you know, red states, they have public electricity. I forget, is it Tennessee is one of the places where it's the largest public electricity services. In fact, I think the entire state might be completely public. But I believe in Washington for electricity, 70% is public. In Oregon, 30% is public. And in Oregon for electricity, we with PGE or Pacific Power pay a higher than the state's average for our electricity, whereas the publicly owned or cooperatively owned electric providers pay less than the state average. It's such a no-brainer. And it's not like we're thinking of, you know, some crazy utopian scheme. Public utilities have existed in this country and other countries for quite a while. Many places, including red states, especially because, you know, rural places, right? Rural places, whether it's broadband or electricity, a lot of corporations just, it wasn't worth it for them. I mean, they had such a big market in urban centers that it wasn't worth it for them to provide services there. And so a lot of rural places were kind of forced to create public or cooperative systems because the corporations wouldn't do it. And ironically, you know, they have better services at a lower cost because of that.
Mm-hmm. So the data in Multnomah County, right, shows that 15% of Portland area households do not have internet access at home. And for households earning under $30,000, that percentage goes up to about 18%. For people who are over age 65, it's 28%. And for Hispanic households, it's 30%. Yes. So digital inequality is a huge issue in Multnomah County.
Yeah. And even the service that they do have is often pretty poor service. I mean, even some of my colleagues during the pandemic Zooming in faculty meetings, I could not hear them because their upload speeds were too slow. So I can't imagine, it wasn't just our students, even faculty members struggled with internet connection, especially if you have more than one household member that's using the service at the same time, which was often the case. So we really have inferior quality and we pay much more for it. And again, because the priorities of investor-owned utilities is not providing the best service at the best price. It is taking advantage of an oligopoly where they know people have very little choice. They can charge whatever they feel like it and make sure their executives make plenty of money, exploit their workers, often contracted workers, and make sure they make plenty of profits to lobby, to keep the laws nationally and locally in their favor and make all kinds of deals with politicians and so forth.
We're coming up again on an election cycle, or, you know, at some point we're already looking forward to the next presidential election. And we know that if a Republican gets in, that the likelihood of net neutrality going down is profound, right? And that's going to have incredible implications for circulation of information, right? And so municipal broadband would be able to preserve access to information across the board without the kind of practice of throttling and marginalizing left media, right? I mean, we're not seeing the marginalization of right-wing media. We're seeing the marginalization of left-wing media and of media that's really looking at expanding the common.
Net neutrality is not an issue that I've taken deep dives on, but I think just with cooperative or publicly owned enterprises and utilities, you know, I should say that they're not automatically perfect, right? Because democracy is imperfect. And as long as we live in under capitalist global capitalism, things are always a challenge. I mean, for instance, you know, whether it's the democratic process or even cooperatives, I mean, many of us belong to cooperatives, including credit unions, but many of us are not very active in them, right? I mean, technically we all have, or even our unions, right? I mean, all these kinds of systems allow for democratic participation. We get to vote on the board of directors, which is very different from investor-owned enterprises and corporations where we have no vote. I mean, you know, technically they say you vote with your dollar, which is a joke. But, you know, even there are people even in the democratic political process that may not participate because they have, under capitalism, they have to work 60 hours a week to pay rent and they don't have time to be informed and they feel cynical under capitalist plutocracy that their vote's not going to make a difference. So I should say that just having cooperative or public utilities doesn't necessarily mean we're going to have economic democracy, but it's a step towards it. And right. Without them, economic democracy is really impossible.
Okay, and we're also talking about money that's going out of the community, and municipal broadband would keep that money in the community. So we've only got a couple minutes left, and I'm just wondering if you can tell us, like, how can people plug into this organizing? How can we support it? How can people who really, really appreciate the idea of municipal broadband and public banks, right? I mean, you know, that's a multi-tiered platform that we're talking about. How can people plug in?
I think the best way to plug in is to contact PMPC. They can go to our website, which is portlandpeoplescoalition.org. And they can email us there to find out with several organizations, including 350 PDX, Sunrise, Climate Action Coalition, et cetera. And so we are involved in the public charter commission meetings and the subcommittee meetings that are going to be happening as well. Right now, there are subcommittees for form of government, elections, and enhancing democracy. And public utilities can really fit under enhancing democracy. It could also fit as part of environmental justice for a lot of different reasons as well. But we do want a separate dedicated subcommittee on environmental justice. All these things really work together. Just having municipal broadband would be great. But if we could have municipal broadband and municipal power, like a lot of places, electric co-ops are actually providing the resources to create municipal or cooperative broadband as well. And if we combine that with a public bank, with the huge amount of money that we would save money on the bonds for the building the infrastructure, I mean, it would create kind of a whole economic development engine to envision all kinds of things that we normally are told we could never afford, right?
We'll definitely have to have you back on. We'll definitely be talking more with people from the Portland Metro People's Coalition and this really important platform that we really hope people will get behind. Yesterday has been Hyung Nam, who's an organizer with the Portland Metro People's Coalition. Thank you so much, Hyung. I just want to refer our listeners also to an earlier interview that Bill Resnick did with Michael Hanna. I think that was from 2018.
On municipal broadband. So we'll post that along with this segment. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Oldham Variety Hour.